Good evening. Good evening and welcome to the Museum of Modern Art and to tonight's conference, The Colors of the Brain. I'm Roxana Markoch, curator in the Department of Photography at the Museum and also co-curator with my colleague Klaus Biesenbach, chief curator of the Media Department of the exhibition Take Your Time, the most comprehensive survey in the United States of the Danish-Icelandic artist Olafur Eliasson. This exhibition, which actually opens to the public at large in next week, on Monday, sort of covers the artist's entire artistic production from 1991 to the present, and will be on view in both locations at MoMA and at our affiliate PS1. So basically, in 1991, when Olafur was still a student at the Royal Academy in Copenhagen, he produced the first work, Wannabe, and at that time he was very much exposed to Gestalt psychology, to all kind of cognitive studies, as well as to the philosophical writings of a number of authors such as Edmund Husserl, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, Martin Heidegger, and a little bit later on, Jean-Luc Nancy, as well as he became exposed to the California light and space artists such as James Turrell, Maria Nordman, and Robert Irwin, and finally also to sort of the discursive practices and social analysis of Gordon Matta-Clark, as well as Michael Asher and Dan Graham. So just to summarize very quickly, tonight's discussion is part of a conference that we are organizing with Columbia University, with the Graduate School of Architecture, as well as with Olafur Studio in Berlin. It's sort of a three-platform type of model that involves three sort of sites of reality production: the museum, the academia, and the artist atelier, and we'll engage a discussion about all kind of artistic as well as scientific experiments with color. And it will go from a very quick introduction into the exhibition that Klaus and I will be making, followed by Barry Bergdahl, Chief Curator of Architecture, who will make a presentation, and then a discussion between Mark Wigley, the Dean of the Graduate School of Architecture at Columbia, with Olafur, moderated by Barry, and then we will open it to the public for a Q&A session.
Yeah, we thought we should introduce, because not all of you had the chance to see the exhibition yet, and not all of you have seen the exhibition completely, because the exhibition is in two locations. And if you look at what you're seeing here on stage, this is an image that Olafur Eliasson's studio produced. And as Roxana was saying, it's a museum, it's the art center, it's a university, and it's also the studio. Olafur has more than 40 people working with him in a team. It's really like a scientific laboratory. There are architects. There are all kind of experimentations going on. And for Roxana and I, it was a great experience to share the last 2 years being part in the studio practice. And we felt it was really an extension of the team that we were generously invited to participate in this kind of production, experimentation, but also editing process, and we are happy that we got several new pieces. So when you look at what you're seeing here on stage, the image created by the studio, depicting the studio, you see the practice, you see different works being carried around, being presented, being tested, and this is the poster of the exhibition, and it's very important the exhibition is both here at MoMA, in the atrium on the third floor, also in the architecture galleries, and it is at PS1. So please do not miss half of it, because it's really one exhibition.
This piece, actually, Barry will be talking at greater length, I hope, about it, but it is a work that is installed in the Architecture and Design Gallery. So basically, for the duration of the show, that the permanent collection of A&D was emptied out in order to welcome this one piece by Olafur, which is titled "I Only See Things When They Move." And in fact, this notion that perception is extraordinarily active and always engaged in the world is very much part of the work. We could talk at great length, but we shouldn't. So
we just quickly mention that if you have a piece of art that's possibly a sculpture, or is this a projection, is this a media piece, or is this a film, or is this architecture, because it's in the architectural gallery. So Olafur was really challenging us as a curatorial department-driven museum, and he said, oh, there's a hallway, oh, we have no labels, this is the architecture gallery. Olafur just is in the process of also kind of working on architectural projects, and we heard him in the press conference, and he said, oh, if you say it's architecture, I don't actually mind, because it is what it is. Your experience is you have a room. And we go further in the exhibition, which is connecting. And Olafur is really changing the logic of the museum, because the architecture galleries and the temporary galleries and the atrium are normally not connected. So Olafur built the hallway into part of the museum, into part of the exhibition space. And while we took the paintings out of the atrium, it's a completely white space where only the fan, the ventilator is moving. You are immersed in colors in the architecture galleries. The walls are full of like these projection of colors. You walk into this space and everything becomes black and white. If you have a red shirt on or a tie or whatever, everything becomes black and white. So it's again depriving you of the perception of color. It's a very experiential approach that let's go to a museum and you walk and finally all the colors are taken out. I think it was for us an incredible experience.
And in fact, in order to sort of compensate for the lack of colors in that room, if you close your eyes or if you look at the white wall as you step out of that room, you will see purple, which is yellow's complementary color as an after image. And this idea of always of the productivity of the eye is part of our discussion tonight on how, in fact, the eye becomes to project onto the artwork and therefore contribute to its making. And so linking to the third floor temporary galleries through that yellow monofrequency room is 360-degree room for all colors, which, as you can see in this slide, is a room that is perfectly circular and therefore completely does away with the standard straight angles of the usual traditional gallery space. And here you are sort of immersed into the full color spectrum, your entire retinal field.
And that was actually part of the reason we thought about the symposium, because while you walk through the monofrequency light and you only see black and white, you look into the next room and you see a purple afterglow. You walk into here and your eyes need, I think it's about 20 seconds to readjust. So you understand that actually the color is completed in your brain.
And then Moss Wall is an installation floor to ceiling exactly of this type of brain deer moss that is organic, is live, and will change throughout the course of the installation, both in color and in shape. And once again, it speaks of the instability, in fact, of color.
But Olafur punched his newly built museum walls, and there is a way of looking into the city, and mirrors carry the city into the museum. Here it's also nature in a way. This is something that's alive brought into the museum. It has to be humidified, it has a smell. So I think it's really a different sense that's added in this room.
This is
now we are jumping actually over the East River. This is the first room at PS1.
Mm-hmm. So you want to talk? Okay. It's a new piece that is called, what is it called? It's called, no, I want to know what it's called, because we had a discussion earlier about the title of this piece, and now it escapes me, but it was an interesting argument that actually Anne Wagner has made. So I was just trying to recall it, the exact title. But basically you are in a room where the ceiling has been transformed into a light box, and which very subtly changes in color. All you see is the color white, but what is really white? the whole idea of how do you upset the notion of the white box is part of this work, because white is never again stable. It always changes and shifts in intensity.
Yeah, it's a piece that was produced newly for the show, so the label is 2008, and Olafur is going to give us the correct title in a minute, I'm sure.
The only natural light setup.
When you see the moss wall, you have these nuances of the wall that's alive, and here you have nuances of white. You spend time in this room, and I think that's a very important component of this exhibition, that it's really also about spending time in the exhibition, adjusting to what you see, completing, understanding yourself. Our colleague Madeline Greenstein, she originated the show, curated it for SF MoMA. She always said there's a wow, and then there's an aha. So first you are mesmerized and you are completely impressed by something that looks miraculous, and then, aha, there is a pipe. Aha, there is a mirror. So you understand the constructedness both of the piece and of nature. When you walk in here, I said there's a room you smell. This is a room that makes you wet. You can just walk through that water that is fogged down from a pipe. And it looks nearly like fire, I think. But I used to describe it before I saw it again and again now. I used to describe it as a rainbow that is a light caught in this fog. And you can walk through, and it ever changes in its shape and in its colors. It's in the vault. We call this vault at PS1.
And then the model room, it's sort of a behind the scenes part of the exhibition where you can see all of these, you know, maquettes and projects. Some of them failed, some of them false starts, some of them wonderful discoveries, from sort of geodesic domes and spirals and lattice form based on mathematical principles and Möbius strips. And in an interesting way, you know, Olafur has been called an experimental artist in an almost scientific way, and that's the truth. There is some Buckminster Fuller and some Naum Gabo and all of these people in these maquettes. And interestingly, throughout what you have seen, these fogs or indoor rainbows or artificial sunsets or all of these experiential room, monofrequency rooms, rooms for one color of 360-degree colors, throughout them, sort of, Olafur, I believe he tries to sort of also show how museums mediate our perception of pure processes, of natural phenomena, thus pointing to this very elliptical relationship between reality, perception, and the representation of the real.
And what you understand here when you look at the room, what is the concept, the curatorial concept made with Olafur? What is at PS1, what is at MoMA? You enter MoMA, it's nearly empty atrium, there is a color projection in the architecture gallery, there is a waterfall and moss in the regular galleries. You come to PS1 and it's really the laboratory, the artist studio, that I think we tried together with Olafur give you an access. So you have all these models, his experimentation, two very generously proportioned room with all these models, and you see the models here on a certain scale, and then you go to the next room and you see one of these models enlarged, and it gives you an idea that the scale jump really changes your perception completely of what you consider a model or a sculpture or another one of these experiential rooms.
And this final piece is again a new piece. It's titled Take Your Time, which is the title of the exhibition. And it's a very large circular mirror that is at PS1 and that practically was designed for this space. It's a mirror that rotates very slowly, sort of one revolution every 2 minutes, and again destabilizes your sort of perception of the space, your depending on if you lie down or stand up, you know, you'll have very different cognitive views of this piece.
And I also want to add that what we give, we only give a very small portion of the show. This is perhaps 25%. Go, please see the show. There are galleries with photography. There is rooms of soil bricks. There are reimagined. There is a waterfall. So it's really a very large, comprehensive show. But Olafur is such a prolific artist that it was for us very important to show the different practices coming together. When you enter this room, there's a beautiful small kaleidoscope also going through the wall here, and you have the disc rotating horizontally above you, and then you look at this small yellow disc circulating vertically in front of you. And I didn't even understand how Olafur was conceiving this until I saw it, and that's a beautiful experience, Olafur, that you were even surprising us. So thank you very much for all your generosity, and we are finishing now, Barry.
All right, this was just a curtain raiser, therefore, for the discussions to be followed today and tomorrow throughout the day at Columbia University. And without further ado, Barry Bergdorf.
I'm actually not going to make a presentation. A few remarks. I'm not going to show any images, but Roxana and Klaus, who coaxed me into this enterprise in which I get to take a somewhat interesting role by not doing anything, and this is the gallery in which I didn't do it. So I just want to talk about that for a few minutes, and then not take my time, but allow us to get on to the business of tonight, which is the only moment that Olafur has allowed himself to be on stage in a place where, of all subjectivities, his is often the one that tries to take a kind of subtle backstage. It seems to me that Olafur does not only produce spectacular experiences in sense in both the French and English senses of that word, sensational events, but also expérience, laboratory-type experiments, here on color, light, and experience, in which subject and object change place, this is continually dialogue even, but he also works continuously on interventions into the very fabrics of institutions. This work was set up for me to sort of approve if I was going to give it the stamp of architecture at a gallery downtown with an opening in a different wall than it receives in our gallery, and it's a very, very different work, not only spatially, but as I want to talk about a little bit institutionally, and therefore in this question of disciplinary boundaries or lines. He's worked closely with all four of us to design this three-part event that we're beginning tonight, which will take place across the institutional lines of the museum tonight, the university tomorrow, and the artist studio via live participation and webcast in a few weeks. In all three settings, Olafur works both with and going against the institutional grain of the roles we conventionally assign to each of those institutions. But there are other lines that have been crossed, and it is one in particular over which I normally exercise some control that Olafur asked to cross and which I eagerly facilitated that I want to talk about for a minute to set the stage for both tonight's conversation and for some of the comments I will like to make myself tomorrow morning as an architectural historian whose expertise is engaged in challenging ways by my recent encounters with Olafur's work. After all, but tonight I want to talk to you in a sense as a curator. After all, or a non-curator. After all, many of Olafur's works contain the word your in their given names, so as to coax us to embrace our own subjectivity, our own position, our own engagement, as he would have it, with both work and institution. So tonight I speak from another subject position, that of Philip Johnson, Chief Curator of Architecture and Design at the Museum of Modern Art, border patrol of a line that Olafur has now crossed. It is not the only one. Olafur's exhibition on this side of the East River flows nearly seamlessly across a multitude of demarcations in the space of the Taniguchi, Johnson, and Goodwin and Stone buildings. And as Mark Wigley knows, I'm only comfortable if I'm reading a building, so the building I'm reading now is this map. I'll get one. The tidal wall you'll encounter on the third floor is in a corridor on a wall that has never since the building opened in 2004 been used as an introduction. In fact, it camouflages a space where you are used to seeing a display of architectural fragments. The first four works that the dutiful visitor who follows the map brochure encounters are in fact not in exhibition spaces at all, as the museum has demarcated places of circulation and places of display. An iconic work has come to be expected in the atrium, so the ready-made pendulum of ventilator takes on a particular reading, a particular experience by the more recent solemnity of that space, that atrium, home until a few months ago of Barnett Newman's obelisk. And the monofrequency work of the corridor transforms the circulation space into a public realm in which everyone looks like a freeze frame from Antonioni's blow-up, a reversal in unexpected ways of color chart on the sixth floor. A momentary view to the garden is afforded by space reversal, which changes in its MoMA's institutional setting by instituting a new relationship momentarily between the garden and the former corridor. Even though the work can be installed elsewhere, its installation here is specific. Not only the institutions of the museum and of the museum public are engaged, but a quite specific set of MoMA icons, MoMA traditions, and by now, MoMA experiences that many visitors have had over and over again. But it is not only the line between the gallery and public space, between inside and outside, that are engaged, but a line across disciplines. When Roxana, Klaus, and then Oliver first spoke to me about crossing the line that separates the corridor, where the title wall appears, from the gallery that serves for the exhibition of selections from the permanent architectural collections of architecture and design, this space, a space that most recently housed the show I organized, 75 Years of Architecture at MoMA, a celebration of this museum's Department of Architecture as the oldest museum department of architecture in the world, they crossed a very powerful line. I don't know if it's as powerful for all the members of the audience as it is for me, but I feel at home when I cross over a line that's no longer there. We discussed and quickly shelved, thank God, an exhibition on the work that might be conventionally associated with architecture. Oliver's collaboration with the Danish architectural firm of Schmidt Henner Lassen on the Museum of Modern Art in Aarhus, where his Your Rainbow Sky deploys some of the phenomenal effects that are deployed here in circular spaces in a very public Danish space. Or the work he is doing now on the facade of the new opera house in Reykjavik, displayed 2 years ago at the Venice Biennale. In other words, we almost immediately sidelined any categorization of Oliver's diverse practice, diverse collaborations both inside and outside the studio, in favor of an approach that would use the institution of MoMA to underscore both existing boundaries and fluid crossings. As curator, I became something of a client here. Oliver visited the space and thought immediately of it as a space perfectly proportioned for the prismatic, multicolored, projected light panorama of the 2004 work, I Only See Things When They Move. What you're looking at. Now that might seem to all of us as the oddest titled work to encounter when we have just passed the silver letters, architecture and design, that serve as the threshold to one part of our departmental galleries. If anything, architecture is the one art that cultivates stability, with some very notable exceptions in the modern period. Tatlin's Monument of the Third International, kinetic work of the 60s and 70s, Rogers and Piano's Pompidou Center leap to mind. Perhaps one might expect better here to encounter a work entitled, I Only See Things When I Move, something closer to the way most buildings are best experienced. So it is the initial defiance of expectations that makes for such a rich experience. Oliver Leeson's work, reinstalled here in this specific architectural institutional setting, now raises the question we are here in tonight in part to address with Mark Wigley, Dean of a School of Architecture. How might we read Oliver's work architecturally? What are its implications for architecture? What does it tell us about architecture or potential architectures, or the experience of architecture, the subject of architecture, the subjectivity of architecture? The room and its institutional coding, the code that precedes the barcode, I guess, helps us raise those questions. So here is a gallery where we as curators generally deploy representations of architecture from our collections. Architectural drawings, models, blueprints, occasionally, as in the recent Lost Vanguard exhibition, photographs of architecture. It is by now a cliche that architectural exhibitions consist of representations, substitute objects. They cannot evoke the real experience of architecture, of space, of color, or light. The Robert Menschel Gallery is now filled with precisely those intangibles. Who is to say that this is not an architectural effect? Never before in the short four-year history of this room has the gallery itself been the subject and the object of the display. I hope this allays the fears of some of my colleagues here in the museum that the public was done a disservice by my willingness for an extended period of time to take architecture off display. The display, like so many of Oliver's works, raises questions in each installation that are specific to their time and to a specific place, your architecture gallery. Tomorrow morning at Columbia, I will speak as an architectural historian of themes and aspects of Oliver's work, and I'll show you some images that aren't Oliver, and themes and aspects of Oliver's work and his artistic practice, which are in dialogue with traditions of architecture that have long fascinated me in my work as a historian of Romanticism, of modernism, and of the issue of architecture and its publics. Tomorrow is a day of the sort that Oliver likes to help engender, a day for discussing issues parallel to his work without addressing his work specifically. Tonight we want to address architecture specifically. This was meant to be the other piece of the puzzle in interpreting architecture for one cycle of MoMA's exhibition calendar through I Only See Things When They Move. Mark Wigley will converse with Oliver. I have already begun to raise questions about why Oliver's work makes us experience space, time, color, and light, architectural intangibles and essentials at once, in both largely familiar and wholly unfamiliar ways. But tonight the interaction is with Mark Wigley and in this institution. Mark Wigley is now best known to you as a prodigious author, lecturer, and educator. But he first came to international attention from a background himself as an architect in the walls of this institution for the show Deconstructivist Architecture that he curated with the man whose name I carry around daily on my MoMA badge, Philip Johnson. Together they introduced works of painting into a show of architectural models and drawings, challenging the media limits of architecture in a way that has been productive ever since in experimental architectural design and discourse. It was not, of course, the first time. This was a theme that had interested Johnson's oft-collaborator Henry Russell Hitchcock with and his whole interest in what he called the passage from painting into architecture. So Oliver's act is at once without precedent and curiously has something of an institutional parallel. Even more importantly, this is not the first conversation that Mark Wigley, author of White Walls, Designer Dresses, has had with Oliver about color in relationship to architecture and to modern architecture in particular. 3 weeks ago, when we dissembled the exhibition 75 Years of Architecture at MoMA, we took down one of the most famous photographs in the history of modern architectural exhibitions, the photograph of the Le Corbusier Room in the 1932 so-called International Style Show here at MoMA, a black and white photograph that hid for many and for many decades the colors readily visible on Le Corbusier's model of the Villa Savoye, colors that included not only green, fleshy pink, and sky blue, but also, of course, as both Mark and Oliver have made us intensely aware, white. Now Oliver has flooded those walls with changing color, with light in the darkness, and an invitation to explore his own statement that he seeks to, quote, create alternatives to the modernist conception of space. Any artist who challenges us like that demands to be engaged by a Department of Architecture and Design that is only too happy to see the department boundary to the probing, demanding, and self-consciously sublime work of Oliver Alison. Join me in congratulating Oliver for the show, and you will now see as he moves onto stage, please, Oliver. We only see you when you move, Oliver. And in welcoming Mark Wigley, who will engage in a question that will no doubt move in and out of architecture in a way that will keep our minds as active as the act of seeing is in an environment that Oliver makes. So they're going to converse, and we'll try to conserve some time, and I'll come back up and moderate some questions from the audience.
Okay, first I'm going to read very quickly what would be the equivalent of the fine print on medication of the side effects. So I'm going to warn you at the beginning the possible side effects of this conversation, and to allow us, in asking you to allow us to have this kind of conversation. Firstly, this is the first of three events on the colors of the brain. It's absolutely not interested in the exhibition of Oliver Eliasson, so he's absolutely freed tonight, for the first time in his life, to not talk about his work so directly. It's not about the exhibition, but it's about the key questions raised by the work. You should anyway remember there are about 38 pieces which are on a display, 38 tests out of about 500 that have been exhibited out of tens of thousands of tests in the studio. So even if we were to talk of this exhibition, we would be speaking about the most minute tip of an iceberg. We go actually to the stage before the exhibition. We go back to that stage of testing, to the 10,000 of tests. And actually, in these three events, we will test the question again in a different way, using a different medium. Firstly, here at MoMA, then at GSAP up at Columbia, then at Oliver's studio. So museum, school, studio, three hosts, Barry tonight, myself tomorrow, and Oliver in May in Berlin. Three different research programs. Barry's own research into the history of the Department of Architecture and Design here at MoMA, Columbia's Global Lab for Art Architecture Experiments, and Oliver's own research, which of course is the very basis of his work. The series goes from very public here to a little bit quieter at Columbia to very private in the studio, but then suddenly broadcasts in the web. So perhaps even the studio becomes the most public space of all. Many, many experts from many different fields in the discussion. The event in Columbia tomorrow maybe is sort of in the middle between the very public moment here and the more private in the studio. Anyone here tonight is very welcome to come up. I should warn you of what you would encounter between 10:15 and 5 p.m. are artists, Oliver himself, art historians, architectural historians, art theorists, cosmologists, cognitive scientists, neurobiologists, poets, and finally a keynote presentation by the architect Stephen Hall. So full force testing of this idea of the colors of the brain. To test something, you have to narrow it down. And for us to have to begin the test tonight with the conversation, I have to really narrow down the kind of question. So I want to take a quick few moments to narrow it down so that you could join in the thinking, so that actually the audience becomes part of the thinking, that a museum would be not just a place to exhibit work and to explain work, but also a place where the work raises questions that cannot simply be explained, questions that need to be thought through, and thought about by everybody, and by everybody I mean artists, curators, critics, theorists, historians, collectors, and visitors. And actually, I guess what I'm saying is everybody would be regarded as a visitor, especially the experts. In other words, how to get the expert in that position of being inquisitive, exploratory, speculative, and precise, all of those being the advantages that visitors to exhibitions have, advantages they have over so-called experts. Exactly, the ability to be precise. The Colors of the Brain project has very much to do with the active space between art and architecture, which has been so eloquently described by Barry, and I follow on from his remarks in our conviction that we don't mean this in the obvious sense. The obvious would be that this is an artist that has directly collaborated with architects making buildings, making large structures in the city, making pavilions, towers, rooms, transforming the normal elements of rooms, the walls, the floors, the ceilings, the windows, and the doors. There's not much left. Even the use of architectural models, you could say. But these are not what's interesting. This is even, I would say, not what's architectural about the work. Actually, the interest here is in the way the line between, and I think Barry refers to this very precisely, the line between art and architecture is actually to be found in that part of the work you at first associate with art rather than with architecture. So we could start to get closer to where this line might be in the slightly less obvious sense of architecture, which is the fact that these kind of perceptual tests that you're allowed to participate in carefully construct a space that all of the work can be entered, that each of these tests is an interior that one enters, that the angle of the lights, the optical illusions, the reflections, the projections, and the perspective, and so on, create an optical instrument that carefully sets up a perceptual space that can be activated by the movement of the body. And in that sense, it would seem we could speak about the architecture of this space. But even this seems to me too obvious, and actually true of most work in general. Even this construction of a space that it has entered is not the key architectural point within the work. And here where I think finally we can narrow the work. The real architectural question, I think, is the construction that goes on within perception itself. And this is where I've warned you, the side effects. Allow yourself to hear this. I mean, as becomes evident in the most subtle mechanics of the works. I mean, for example, the dynamics of the after image, and in particular, those works in which the electronics move the light just at the same speed as your eyes can adjust, therefore simultaneously exposing and defeating the mechanism of the eye. In other words, not just bringing perception into the foreground, which is, let's say, a typical description of this work, but the timing of perception itself as an action, as an activity. In other words, what I'm going to begin, and this is the beginning of the question, in which way is perception itself already architectural by virtue of being an active construction, that perception builds space, that perception constructs something, an active construction that comes, let's say, before the recognition of a space that you are in, that comes even before, and especially before, the recognition of a building, let's say, such that, and to really be narrow here, it makes more sense to say that color is in the brain than in the world. So in other words, it's just a kind of an attempt to be very precise, let's say, about the possibility that perception here turned into construction is already architecture. And I thought the only way we could start this is just to continue our old conversation about the color white. What about the color white?
I think it's very generous what you say, because it's very open, and obviously saying something very open takes a bit of time, which it is all about, I guess. But the challenge with the color white is, as I have discussed with you and suggested occasionally, the biggest mistake we can do is to take the color white for granted as being something given to us by objective means, as if the color white was out there in the world, externalized from us, and we could just address it by looking at it, or address it as if it was created by somebody related to the visit we had in New York today. So the color white, and that was the Pope, if I was too unclear there. No, so the color white, I think, needs to be addressed as a kind of internal matter, and as an issue of great contextual dependency. And in that sense, it opens up suddenly for a whole degree of relativity. And what more generous is there than a kind of white wall, which is relatively white? Mm-hmm. And within that, and that's where the constructive kind of perception code comes in, within that relativity, there is the chances that you might engage in order to constitute it. And the white wall itself is not necessarily the issue, but the constitutional quality of your engagement as a kind of a cause and effect. And you go in there and you say, I see this, and as I see this, I constitute it. And by doing it this way, rather than allowing the wall or the whiteness to constitute me, I also give it a place in the world. And being in the world, it has a context. And having a context makes it physical, temporal, and it becomes a part of a greater, let's say, a greater trajectory, where art sometimes suffers from having excluded it into more or less avant-garde pockets, or more or less timeless pockets, timeless museums, for one thing. And obviously the great challenge, and why I'm inspired by the way that Mark or architecture as such is addressing such issue, is that it recontextualizes something that I think has been left autonomous, non-negotiable. It's been left out there as if it was to be taken for granted, where it is, in fact, a measure to put ourselves within a contextual grid. Mm-hmm. So this is why I think a museum like this, and to some extent it happens, it doesn't always happen, and it doesn't happen often enough for sure, owe it to the spectator to tell them, surely this is a white wall, surely that has a history, but it is also white because the color white, and this is something you know better, has a history. Which is a cultural history. Mm-hmm. It's not a natural history. Mm-hmm. I think one could throw the argument, and this is still to be discussed, that was it chalk? That you could purify wounds in when you cut, when you in alchemy, or Renaissance or alchemy time, when you would clean a wound, when you would cover a mass grave in order to avoid bacterial you put chalk. Mm-hmm. And white kind of became a purifying, chalk became purifying. I mean, chalk was white, and soon they would whitewash the hospitals as a kind of a cleaning. And of course, the church was not slow to catch up on that, knowing how they work and so on. But then, when modernity came around, and this is then really, it's a little more complex and doesn't really do it justice, but nevertheless, then of course the whole idea of white became something else, and the salons changed, the salons with the paintings, and we went into the beginning of white spaces, which at this point wasn't white, and the And the media had an impact suddenly, as Beatrice has wisely shared with us, how then photography of, you know, walls in the papers were white, and they were in fact not quite white, and so on and so forth. So here we are today, owing the audience that the space in which we stand, it is not white per se, but per definition, it is white because this is the culture in which the Western society developed a museum. Right. And had chalk been yellow or blue from the beginning, the museum might have looked completely different today.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually, there was that thing, you know, that thing that if you really want to make your clothes really white, you have to add blue, right? And what I noticed is that to make a room black and white, you have to add yellow. Right, in your work. So I know it's a stupid question, but it's inevitable. Is white a color?
Well, that's a cultural question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's better not to answer that.
Okay. But in your, I mean, because it could be not a color or all color, right? I mean, it seems to me that the moment you insert into white time, which you just did by making it relative, on the one hand by making it relative, but also in the bigger sense making it historical, you open up a space, right? And it seems to me this is, you see, I'm interested in that space itself being thought of in architectural terms. And if I understand you right, for you this space is also a space of some optimism, because you speak of the possibility of taking responsibility in that space. You can renegotiate, you can engage, you can think.
Yes, so that's the question. So why would a spatial context owe it to the people in it to tell it them that it is constructed and not made by God, for instance?
Yeah.
So why is that interesting? I think in the interest of reflexivity, in terms of the interest of introducing the feeling of being by means of being a part of a world, being singular or being collective or being plural in the sense of, you know, being a part of something where collectivity makes a difference rather than being, I mean, not individual but kind of non-collective. So suddenly the whole idea of the color white, or the idea of the space allowing you to use it as a tool or utilitarian tool, suddenly it makes a difference in order to evaluate whether you are a part of something else, not something larger or not something not something modern necessarily, but really about and obviously me with my work and my personal history, I have an interest in keeping such a place like the one we are in now in a kind of relationship to society. I have an interest in that this place is kind of amplified by integrating it into society, by being a part of society.
Yeah.
So every kind of socio-ethical or socio-political or way that the museum can interact with time or temporality or society and so on. And that's why it is of major importance that the wall is not to be taken for granted.
Yeah. And so color is a social issue.
Yes, of course. But look at it. So I mean, social issue just sounds so limiting in a sense in this context. No, social issue in the sense of we can do a small experiment here. I was just doing it myself, not looking away. I was looking at the exit signs in this room. Actually, you draw my attention to it as usual. But the point is, as you can see, first of all, we are in a space with designed exit signs, which is the only museum in the world where the exit sign looks like the entrance to a bar in Tokyo or something. but the interesting thing is, and there are so many in here that if we can just do it, it's going to take 12 seconds, a small experiment. And can we start by, if there's anybody up there, still take the light level in on the stage down a little bit? Which is going to become more comfortable anyway.
It's true.
If we take that, if you're listening at all up there, take the light level at the stage just down a little bit. But I'm going to ask you now for roughly 8 seconds to look at the center of the X, and just to explain the exercise. Okay, this is fine. If you explain the exercise, if you look at the center of the X for 12 seconds, and there will be a little black dot rising in the center of the X, and just keep looking at that. And if we start now, I can keep talking, and if you keep focused, don't look away, don't shake your head, look at the X, and then look, 5, 6, 7, keep looking, 8, and then shift your eyes to the white wall beside it. You should have a blue exit sign, probably drifting around a bit. If you need to stop it from drifting, you can place it, you can look at something specific. You can do it as we go on. You can keep doing this.
exit.
No, but the point is obviously that color the construction of the perception is highly contextual and very relative, as the kind of retinal material in our eyes is very different for all of us. Like physiologically speaking, we don't have the same amount of kind of color receptors in our eyes. We have red, green. We have roughly the same, but we don't really have the same. And we don't use it in the same way also, but there's a green, blue, and red. We don't have yellow, actually. That's why the yellow room takes advantage of both using the green and the red, which is why it's stronger, because it uses kind of twice as much chemicals, and that's why the experience of yellow is kind of more powerful than the one of blue, for instance. So do you see the fact that I gave you a film called Exit? That took 8 seconds. It was a short movie. And then you gave me back the rest of the film, which took roughly 5 seconds or 60% of the time. You gave that part. So we did a film together. I did the red part. You did the complementary color. Mm-hmm. And we had a kind of exchange there, or sort of a dialogue. We co-produced a film. We co-produced and co-constituted a sort of situation. This, I think, is a generous idea, in the sense that we not only did a film, but all of you did your own film, yeah. And we were together. So do something, and so how rare is that? Doing something, you know, together, which was unique. I mean, individual in the sense that we were both collective and individual.
See, now if you play for the architectural team as I do, what you want to do is, of course, claim all generosity. And what you just described is a form of generosity. And also you gave it to the audience as a gift, which turned out to be this gift they produced. So actually you gave them a gift that they produced, which actually is an interesting kind of generosity, right? You allow somebody to give themselves a gift. And for me, to read it from an architect's point of view, you made a space. And so generosity allows for action in this case, mm-hmm. Right? And I think it's in this sense that I want to argue that precisely with the after image argument, that the literal space, also the eye moved to another space, so that the space and time of that constitutes, let's say, an architectural construction. And it's a construction close in spirit to the way we think about perception itself. So it helps us to see perception, right? Mm-hmm. But you said at one moment that that waves and frequencies, about which you're an incredible expert, seems to me. You have real expertise. Yes. I've seen you be unbelievably precise about hue. You know, you are really precise about that. You described them once as spatial properties. How you mean? Of course it's spatial in a mathematical sense, but you mean something more.
Yes. I don't remember, Mark, but I think, I mean, I always thought of color as being, depthful. And I mean this in a completely unmystical or kind of very utilitarian way. When I said depthful, I just mean in terms of a sort of engagement sequence, and that being a dimension all by itself. So you could call, architectural team or not, you have a history of the last 10 years working with CAD programs in mm-hmm. spatial production, and in that CAD program, if you're very good, you introduce degrees of temporality, or timely, as some architects more or less successfully introduces. Stephen Hall, for one, has kind of tried to do that, and so on and so forth. But what about the dimension called your engagement, or your engagement sequence? I call it the your engagement sequence dimension. Mm-hmm. That is a very utilitarian dimension. It's very productive. It is the kind of relativity you can inflict upon the four other dimensions by simply participating or by, you know, engaging yourself. Let's not use the word immersive, because immersive is just like kind of so unproductive, because the wellness industry took kind of a patent on it and stigmatized it. But the fact that you would actually want to say that the way I walk down the street bloody constitutes the street. The way I look at it has an impact. The whole idea of this is so attractive, and obviously I think the museum should support that notion in its trajectory of communicating what a street and what a person within that is. Now I say a museum because we're in the museum today, but, and this is how I see color then. At the end of the day, it's a long push. It's very abstract, obviously, but it's worth it nevertheless. I did some experiments with a guy from the Department of Psychophysics in Leeds University, a young Australian guy who were measuring the difference between how you saw color and how I saw color. And there's ways of doing that. And of course, it's significant.
Yeah.
But the way then you and I could sit down and talk it would change it all again.
Yeah.
Which was much more interesting.
But I totally agree that the word immersive is wrong, because it implies that the space of the work is an interior that exists before you enter, mm-hmm. Would you immerse yourself
yes.
in it?
Yes.
And it seems to me, in a certain way, if you follow with what your work is testing, it seems to me, it doesn't really make sense to say that you are in the light, mm-hmm. or even that you're in color, mm-hmm. because exactly this what you call this depth, mm-hmm. this depth of the color, has more to do with time. Right, than we would normally associate with space. So if you say, I'm in the light, it seems like you stand there and you are receiving the light. But exactly mm-hmm. the way we are going is to insist that you are mm-hmm. producing mm-hmm. this architecture.
Mm-hmm.
So you are not simply in an architecture, it's much more that you are making it. So you're not so much immersed in it as building it.
So I agree. So temporality is the key to the relativity of the depthness.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God, that was... Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Okay. This leads to a question. Because for me, you see, what would be interesting is, and actually even urgent, would be to associate this idea of construction, like perception as a form of constructing the world, and therefore the world not being simply outside you. Let's say it's a familiar idea.
Mm-hmm.
But associating this idea of perception as a form of construction, literally with the idea of constructing space, like literally taking seriously this word construction, right? So if perception is not receiving the world, but constructing the world,
mm-hmm.
this is then a world, something that is built up, meaning built up in time, like it takes time,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the time aspect that I'm going to insist makes it architectural.
Mm-hmm.
I can ask it as a straightforward question. I think one of the effects of your work, of these tests, is actually the effect of slow motion, which includes this movie we just made, because I think it's a slow motion movie.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, we found ourselves mm-hmm. in the space between the exit sign and the after image, and it was quite slow, that space. And it makes sense to me that if you open up inside perception an awareness of time,
mm-hmm.
in other words, you don't short-circuit the question of time. Of course, the effect will be that things seem to slow down,
mm-hmm.
right? And
mm-hmm.
I think if you look at a lot of your work, one of the dominant effects is the slowing of time. And actually, sometimes you stop time. Right? A number of the pieces have to do with actually stopping time. I mean, the most mm-hmm. obvious with the water drops.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go one step further. Couldn't you consider, at least as an ambition for the work, to reverse time? So, for example, the reverse waterfall is not just a trick, mm-hmm. but an ambition. That, in a way, for example, if I meet your work and I feel myself constructing the space and I slow down in that feeling, but I'm also allowed to see the mechanism that allowed that to happen. Mm-hmm. In seeing the mechanism, I'm mm-hmm. sort of then going back. In other words, you go effect, you go, mm-hmm. the experience of the work is from effect to the cause,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Opposite of the normal story. That's reversing time, no? Is it a ludicrous ambition, but it seems to be in the work?
It's very interesting. You should come and work in my studio.
No, but you know what I mean, no?
Yes, I do. But mean, I might have a slightly more didactic take on it, in the sense that I do see that the potential for recontextualizing or kind of giving the work that I do a place in the world is temporality, especially since the rest of the world seems obsessed by depriving life of temporality for the sake of profitability. So if you don't mind me just start going back to the beginning of the argument,
yeah.
Temporality introduces relativity to this object. The time it takes for you to engage with it changes it. That makes it hard to sell. Because if it's maybe a glass, it's not as easy to sell. If this is a kind of a Danish design glass, then it's easy to sell. If it's potentially a glass, it's very hard to have a store with maybe things. If it's maybe a pair of blue jeans, maybe they're blue. That's counterproductive to.
Yeah. Yeah.
So suddenly deprive instant classic, timeless classic. Everything which has no time is like better than. So obviously this kind of relativity, which would embrace the fact of subjective production or self-production or self-reflexivity.
Mm.
So I just want to make that one larger frame of reference, in the sense that we are surrounded of a world which has an interest in kind of organizing time into objects or into units or into understandable entities. So the phenomenology that which I have grown up in since the 90s has suddenly given me access to thinking about time in all these different ways. Reintroduced Bergson, reintroduced the idea of duration in a much more productive way. And suddenly I can suggest that the relativity inflicted on this glass by me engaging on it as an object makes sense in the context of being in an art museum. Because suddenly the whole idea of my work in this show, is that new work or is that old work? I did it 10 years ago. But obviously it's new work, because I'm showing it. It just happened to lay around for 10 years until we show it here. So in that sense, time has a quite coherent relationship with now, and it is within that now that the kind of dimension or depth which you're talking about, I think, can be found. But I see it very much in the context of this timelessness that surrounds us.
The dogma of timelessness.
Yes, in the fetishizing, the kind of fetishized idea of time that surrounds us. There is though details to this. You mentioned the waterfall. Gravity is, as we know it from right now at least, pretty constant. And our gravity to Earth is temporal as it performs itself. It pulls us down. And that's also the case with water, and water always falls with the same speed. It's not, you don't have fast falling water and slow falling water. Droplets fall the same speed regardless of their size, roughly. So because gravity is constant, and that is one thing which is interesting. So temporality lends itself to other ways of measuring. So look at and I say this because of obvious reasons, as I'm working on making some waterfalls which actually falls. It's so to speak, it's free falling water. It's both free because it's public art in it's being in the museum again, but it's also free falling. And what happens is, when you look at water, and I know this from Iceland and the Simien Mountains in Ethiopia, when you look across a valley and you see a waterfall, you can look at the water, and by telling how fast it runs in this otherwise static picture, by looking at the pace of the falling water, you can tell how far the water is away from you. Because it falls very, very, very slow, it must be a really big waterfall very far away. If it's really falling like this, it's probably only 50 feet away and it's a tiny waterfall. And suddenly the whole landscape kicks into a sync with your body. And suddenly physicality, you being there, temporality, the way you read the water in the context of a space, and this through the time it takes for you to actually look at it fall, suddenly that allows you to be in the space in a whole different or in a different way. This is also what happens when you walk. You walk and you see the mountain doesn't get closer, but you keep walking, it doesn't move. It's very tall and it's very far away, and that's how you build up a relationship. This is why I think the falling water in the context of the New York Harbor, which has a history of being representational by means of power structures, yeah, by means of architectural sort of iconic tourist attractions. So by introducing temporality, I can also introduce subjectivity, collectivity, and socio-ethical kind of experiments.
Yeah, exactly. But you again, if just listening very much from the outside, you take falling water and you slow it down, you stretch it out, you give it the possibility of being near and far. You give it, you stretch it out. And it seems to me all of these tests involve sort of stretching out the perception. And it's actually the stretching out that brings perception itself, at least makes it a question, right?
Well, I think stretching out, if the situation is generous, you tend to be more, you develop more attention, and you generate that stretching out. So I guess I think of it differently, because you have a kind of a more, a kind of a less hospitable situation, and it compresses everything, and it's more aggressive. Then it doesn't stretch out, because your attention are being diverted into all kinds of other things.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that might be a way to think about it for me. So this is why, by making it, in this case the waterfalls, by doing it on a scaffold, which is easily constructed, people go, aha, scaffold, easy, no problem. Then they look at the water. The attention is uncomplicated. It's generous in that sense, like the sign. You can do the same experiment with my blue sweater while I talk. On first look here, or at least here, it's the generosity lays. Keep asking your interesting questions.
No. I mean, we have to almost finish, I think. But where we're going, and it's always a pleasure and frustratingly short speaking about time. But we have these three sessions to work it through. But what's coming a little bit more clear in this conversation is kind of, as it were, what I would say is stretching out to allow time, right, to become clear.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
This constitutes a form of generosity.
Yes.
And architecture is not a set of walls. Architecture attempts to be a gift, attempts to make a space for something positive. So from this sense, your opening up of time, what I would say opening up of time, I think slowing time, and I will eventually insist in another conversation, reversing time, or at least giving the sense of a reversal of time, constitutes another way of thinking about architecture. And this would be, let's say, your gift to our field. The question is, do we have time for a few questions from the audience? Okay, so Barry's going to moderate the... Why don't you join us in the...
Going from being the non-curator to the non-conversationalist. But we have to unhappily leave the room at 7:30 for a film. So if you want to take reverse time and you want to perform one of your experiments and make it happen, we can expand the time for conversation. But we'd like to open it up to the audience. There are some migrating microphones. I see one there in the back, red against white.
I think it's purple, but... I apologize if this question moves away from the specific theme of this dialogue, which is, of course, colors of the brain and perception. But I couldn't help thinking... that within all this talk of perception and construction of space, we're neglecting a category of individuals who lack sight. And I wanted to know, Olafur, if you have considered doing experiments that engage perception through other sensations rather than sight. Could it, touch, fatigue, as you say, you're walking towards the waterfall and you see the changing distance through your perception? What about the fatigue in one's body? And I had one other thing, but I don't remember right now.
But that's good.
That's a good question. I did. It's funny you should ask, because the title, I Only See Things When They Move, that you were talking about actually came from reading about blindness and our very reduced sight. And one of the, in some text or somewhere, that came up, I only see things when they move. And the fact that things would be only visible embedded in a temporal relationship was so attractive to me that that is... now you know how I do the title. It's just like, oh, this sounds great. No, but the fact, the actually specific text was because I was researching the potential of doing a piece which were a kind of a belly presser, sort of a box you have on your belly that has been constructed as an experiment with reduced sight phenomenons, and you have it, and then it actually physically... kind of translates the graphic of what you're looking at into kind of a body pressure. Mm-hmm. But obviously it only works, or apparently, not obviously, but apparently it only works when actually you or this, the thing in front of you move. You cannot somehow feel a person standing in the room as I understand it. And then if the person moves suddenly, you can tell, oh, there's a person walking through the space by virtue of the touch. And I was very interested in this, the whole idea of, let's say, going from the mind to the body, and that you could see with your skin. And there's that wonderful book by Palasma, The Eye of the Skin, the fact that you would want to consider that the spatial notion is not in the kind of... way our mind has taken a patent on taking in space, but the way you physically would kind of move through the space, and this is now I'm like kind of surrounded about the wrong people to sit and say this as if I say something sensible, but this is something that has inspired me a lot, and the fact that I had the chance to do this architectural pavilion at the Serpentine Gallery last summer was very much about this. It was about slopes and slants, and not at all in the Sahadidian way, because I think this is something else. But the fact that you would kind of struggle a tiny bit with gravity, and that would give you a sense of physical seeing, putting the eye into the skin. So that piece kind of developed out of this argument. It's not that it really looks like it, but it did.
All the way down here, the front row, could we have a mic?
Hello. Should I go there? Yeah.
All right.
I couldn't help thinking of Messiaen's The End of Time, the piece of music. Anyway, it's a piece of music. It's called The End of Time, and it stretches out time using your sense of hearing. And that related to the question before. Would you connect music? I kept thinking about music and how music affects our senses and our perceptions. Do you ever think of music?
Oh yeah, all the time. I haven't found a kind of non-exploitative way of introducing sound into my work because it's just so seductive, just to answer it sort of short. But I can keep looking into it. And who knows? I mean, had we had music for looking at the exit sign, it has become a drama instantly, and I'm just not so interested in that. So, but I keep looking at it because there must be a way of doing it. And I am doing I did an opera set last year, and I'm doing a kind of a sort of rock concert set this year. So I just haven't found a way yet.
Could we have the mic down to the very front, please?
The Virgin and the Lamb, the white, the two white forms there, whether you think that constitutes white as a color there, because you said you wouldn't answer it, but those are the two of the most striking whites that I've ever seen, so I wondered if you... you could comment. And then I have another question about when you look at the exit, why does the exit sign move? Why, when you look at it, does it always shift out of your sight? Do you know why that is?
Well, I think, first of all, no, I do not know that work that you referred to, so that was easy to answer. and I know I should. Would know it. No, and the reason why your projected image floats around, and you can exercise it if you, like me, get obsessive with this, you can actually become very good at sort of sail your after image around in a productive way. But the thing is, looking at your after image is by virtue not possible. So what you look at is obviously not on the wall, but it's in your eye. And the tendency is, if you're very focused, it doesn't move. And then it starts to sail, but then your eyes shift to match it. Then it sails more, and you have a, it's called something, and it's something with acceleration, because you kind of, it goes like, woof, you can do that. I have done some sort of stage things where I sort of draw in with a light, draw into the retina some years ago, into the eyes of people, and that's obviously sort of floating all over the place and got a little bit out of hand. but there is a number of people researching these sort of retinal phenomena.
Yeah, but just to add a footnote, I think this phenomenon of chasing the after image, it's for me just a good clear example of what's happening in almost all of the projects, almost all of the pieces. You chase the possibility that you see yourself seeing, and it's the chase that puts the time in, right? So I think it's and also the other thing that occurs to me is that, of course, this is not a special thing. This constantly you are chasing a million, and actually there's nothing other than the chase.
There are so many wonderful things you can do. If you jog in the evening and there's a street light and you just keep looking at it, a long road, and you just keep running, and you just kind of run and look at the light, and you run and look at the light, and then you get home, and then you sit down all sweaty, then you have this amazing kind of drawing in your eyes. And you can, it's like,
rewinding time. Yes.
You can see a drawing of your jog,
yeah.
If you want. A little drawing.
We have a question back here.
It's a question about the difference between, I guess, emptiness and nothingness. And you're talking about when a subject enters your space, it's a temporal construction of the space. And I guess I'm wondering, temporally, what frames that space? Is it, you know, before and after the subject enters and leaves the space? Is it? Can you understand it in terms of emptiness and nothingness? And if so, what would be the difference?
Well, I'm much more pragmatic. I don't think if you're not in the space, it's not. Then there's nothing there. If you ask me, that's why I have a hard time with architects sometimes, because it's like they talk about it as if it's always there. And obviously, it's only there when you are there. If you ask me, but that doesn't. I mean, it depends on what you're talking about. So it's the answer is very unclear. I'm sorry. But I think, I only think it's interesting if it's a dialogue. I only think art is interesting if somebody's looking at it. I don't think art per se has a kind of universal value or anything. I don't think art is important unless it's a part of the society or the world or you. I know the art market disagrees. There's a whole other lecture, you know, over there, and so on. But I really think this is important to say.
Maybe if you speak loudly, you can do it without
question.
Mic. Yeah, we have one more question. Yeah, go ahead. Can you speak loudly?
My question is, in the argument, we set up sort of cultural examples and then physiological. And so my question is, where do they intersect, and which do we trust as far as experiments are going, and how does that then relate to the way color is seen
throughout the lifetime of a human, as far as what are you taught when you're little about color and the culture you come from, and what is your natural physiological response to color as a child, and then in the culture that you are a part of as you grow, your determination of what that color is, coinciding with the physiology of the human as it extends to their perception of color.
Yes, incredibly interesting. Incredibly interesting. I mean, also very complex. But I do think it is clear that our introduction to color is unusually cultural and also stigmatized by language, as if, you know, blue is only blue and that a child has to kind of deal with that. There is I mean, it's an old argument, but they say that in Greenland they have 30 colors for white, but referring to the texture of the snow. So white is really not described as a color, but the kind of crisp or not so crisp sort of, and the fact that there would be a tangible dimension to color seems, I mean, for children, a really healthy way to address the world, right? Instead of just a word being something that you can kind of tangible in invest yourself in. And then the whole idea of, I think we owe it to the way we walk through the world to take upon the responsibility to say that we produce the colors. Neuroscience has apparently the last few months only come to the conclusion that the only right way to address color is to consider something we project, mm-hmm. which is what you said altogether. You were there, you have been there for a while. So. And it seems that it's a question of evolutionary kind of, this apple is red, I will eat it because then I will survive. And that's how the red came. The red wasn't on the apple before we had to eat it. The apple wasn't even, I mean, the color is not out in the world per se. And what an interesting argument thinking about sort of concluding this, thinking about that there is a kind of Van Gogh painting hanging over there, and the fact is that this new knowledge, or this whole new idea, and the children, and the kind of growing up, and the change of color, and that that life span, the fact that the Van Gogh is relative, despite the couple of $100 million being not so relative, but the fact that it is a relatively colored painting, and what an exciting concept considering the potential of the Van Gogh today, rather than suggesting going back to it, looking at this as if it was a universal state of objective non-negotiable quality. So suddenly we are in a house which has to shift its notion of what is then responsible. How do we talk to children about color? How do we hang a painting on the wall? Is the wall then, what color is the wall? Is the painting only the painting, or is it also the white color? And there is an issue there where suddenly hospitality and the generosity becomes about responsibility. Being responsible, not exploiting people, not patronize people and patronize children. Maybe I should just leave it kind of inconclusive, this long sentence, as this seems to be more productive. So thank you very much.
Thank you.